everybody. Welcome to Film Gold. This is a new film podcast. So my name is Anthony, and I'm with Jay Crash in the car. I'm sure that's not your real name, is it?
It's not. You can call me Jay Crash.
I see. Jay Crash and I, we met recently online. Or in fact, I knew your channel for a while. I'll get you to tell us about that in a sec. But when did you find my channel? I have a ContraFib YouTube channel.
I remember you had visited my channel just for music because you're also a musician. Primarily on my channel is I am an independent musician, songwriter, do post my music online. We kind of originally met through the music community, and I think we both discovered that we each really enjoy films and we're both big film buffs. And I think it kind of just prompted this whole discussion that we ended up having. And then you invited me on the Film Gold podcast. So I'm really excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Well, we met on Zoom about a month ago and I was in the park. It was a lovely summer's day, just coming to the end of the English summer. And we kind of cooked this up.
Well, I was going to say, it's cool because we have a guy from Britain and a guy from California. So, you know, though we do have a lot in common film-wise, we do come from different parts of the world. And it's definitely made our discussions a lot more interesting, I think.
Yeah, and that's something we can develop because we, just to say to the audience, we kind of don't know exactly where this is going to go, but we've got plenty of plans. I'm sure we're going to do a mixture of British and American films in the future, and maybe we can do that. We can talk about how the films are perceived. We both have a ton of ideas, I guess, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, this accumulated knowledge that we're bringing here. But anyway, so let's just do proper introduction. So I'll just talk briefly about myself. So my main thing at the moment is I have a podcast about John Lennon called Glass Onion on John Lennon, and you can find that in all the places where you would normally would find podcasts. So iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube as well, though that's not really the main channel for that. And it's a deep dive into John Lennon. I'm a Beatles obsessive. I am also a musician, but I'd say I'd pretty much retired. I made 3 studio and 2 live albums while I was in Madrid in the kind of expat community, but with some Spanish musicians and South American musicians that contributed. I have a blog. I'll put everything in the show notes, by the way. I have a blog, which is, I guess it's sort of activistic in nature. It was about alternative information and trying to offer different perspectives, but I haven't written on that for ages. So I guess the main thing I've got going at the moment is a podcast, but my main interest would be music, psychology, film, and I don't know, how the world works, let's call it, you know?
Politics. We're all trying to figure that out, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I believe I go with the Socratic thing that the wisest thing is knowing what you don't know. And I don't think we have a clue what really goes on behind the scenes. But, you know, we get fed scraps on the news every day and we can try and piece it together, you know. But anyway, Jay Crash, can you introduce yourself to the audience, please?
Yeah. So really big thanks for having me here today, Anthony, and for inviting me on the podcast. And I'm really excited to be a part of it. And my name is Jay Crash. I go by Jay Crash in the Car. And originally, Jay Crash in the Car was sort of an idea for a YouTube channel that I had, which was basically just kind of covering a lot of the things that you mentioned that you're into. And the concept was sort of all the things you think about when you're just behind the wheel. And, you know, I'm down here in Southern California. And as you know, I mean, our lives are structured around driving. You know, we have a lot of urban sprawl. So we're always in our cars. And I was in a, you know, position where I spent a lot of time in my vehicle, just listening to different things, contemplating different things. And sort of this thought that weaves in and out of your consciousness while you're behind the wheel. And I started out, you know, just really wanting to just talk about films and different films that I had seen, old classics, films that I really love, things that I didn't like. And, you know, I have been a musician since, you know, really my early teens. I grew up playing in several bands, independent bands, and really got into writing my own material as a solo artist and just kind of decided over time to really share that to sort of change the scope, or at least broaden the scope of J-Crash in the Car, which was really to just include my original music and the persona that is J-Crash in the Car. And so I'm posting usually about a song a month. I record and produce my own music, and I am lucky to be associated with some really great musicians. One in particular is a guy named Daisy Nichols. We all go by pseudonyms. It's kind of the fun part, I guess. And he's a longtime friend, co-writer, bandmate of mine. Fantastic piano player, keyboard player, synths, everything. And I'm just fortunate enough to be associated with a lot of really other good musicians that I've had really long-standing relationships with. We were in bands together that have had albums out before. And we just started doing our own thing under, you know, our pseudonyms. And that's kind of how it evolved. But I've also been doing, you know, over the course of the last year, a top 200 film countdown, where I get into kind of discussing, you know, a little blurb about each of these 200 films that I've selected. And really, that list is a compilation of films that I spent a lot of time thinking about, going back to films that I once thought were great. And I really put a lot of thought into this evolving list that I had been doing for really about a decade. And so I finally like, well, I got to get this down on YouTube, on my channel, and just kind of document it. I currently have 50 films to go, and I will be releasing, the segments come in 10 at a time. And so I will be releasing the final 50 films here over the next month or two. And hopefully by the end of the year, we'll be down to number one. And I think that was also one of the ways we connected, Anthony, was that you were commenting on my countdown, and we got into these kind of side discussions about things. And then really it was obvious from the get-go how knowledgeable you were about films and how studious you are as a person that's looking for answers to just a lot of things, and really diving deep into different aspects of film that I think maybe are overlooked by the casual viewer.
Yeah, I mean, I've discovered some great deep dive film podcasts over the last few years. But the reason I wanted in my own one is that I still feel that there are gaps, which is not to say that other people are doing it wrong, not saying that, but I believe that having done the John Lennon, and as we're speaking now, which is sort of late October, I've done 55 episodes and 5 bonus episodes about John Lennon. And that's about 90 hours of content. And it's that amazing thing where if you don't think about it too much and you don't project too far, you know, I mean, I probably, if you'd asked me at the beginning, I would have probably said, oh, I'll do 30 episodes. But when I stop projecting, then you just find it goes on and on. And there's always more and more to say. And in a minute, I'm going to share with the listeners some of the films that we both have on our top 100. I've never done officially a top 100, but I know the ones that would be in it. Mm-hmm. So we'll go through that in a second. So I guess Film Gold is going to be a mixture of deep dives into films, and then we're going to put clips, I imagine, on YouTube. We might, you know, take little segments, which is something I've done very occasionally with Glass Onion. And then we might say, you know, one of your suggestions was about how films have evolved and kind of got lost a bit in the last 10 years of film, which is not to say that there aren't great films out there. You know, one of the ones you've reviewed, Nebraska, is a good example of a, what's the word, kind of a quiet film, if you know what I mean, meaning
yes,
sort of longer shots and not dependent on action. I mean, there's action in it, but it's not action sequences. So one of the things that's come up, well, one of the things that comes up pretty much anytime I talk to anyone about films is what I call, or has been called, the Easy Riders to Raging Bulls period. And through our prior discussions and discussions with other people, I've kind of worked out that it's somewhere, in fact, between Bonnie and Clyde or The Graduate, which is 67, which is 2 years before Easy Rider. And it goes up to about Raging Bull and probably the film Heaven's Gate, which I've never seen, but which apparently nearly bankrupted the studio. I don't remember the studio, but so, you know, the way I would characterize that period is that it was an amazing time. I mean, obviously you had the 60s in music, and I feel like New Hollywood, if you want to call it that, the Hollywood New Wave, it kind of followed 4 or 5 years behind the music, perhaps. I don't know. That's probably debatable. But I feel like it was a period where you had the first film schools. So you had, you know, Scorsese, Coppola, De Palma. I don't know if Spielberg went to film school, but anyway, they're coming out of film school. It was also a period where the film execs were doing a little too much of the Colombian marching powder, and they kind of took their eye off the ball, as we'd say in England. Probably say that anyway. You know, the director started to get a bit more power, and I think it was just a sort of liberal, not politically liberal necessarily, because Nixon was in the White House, but liberal small L feeling of kind of anything goes. So all these film school guys, the film brats, as they called them, you know, had been studying Russian and German expressionist cinema, French New Wave, Italian neo-noir, that kind of thing.
Right.
So you had this amazing run of 10 years or so of films that kind of looked a lot like documentaries. I mean, you told me you watched French Connection recently. That's a very good example. You know, it's got long tracking shots. So are you very familiar with that period of film, and would that be among your favorites, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say it's interesting to look at my list, and without giving away my top films in the order that I'm going to be presenting in my countdown, it's interesting when I look over my films that are really, let's say we're kind of discussing our sort of what's in our top 100 films, and I look at the dates of those films, and it's a really interesting combination of years. And I think I've really tried to be objective in looking. I think it's important when you look at a film to also understand the time range and what was sort of happening in the world, not only happening in the world, but happening in the micro world of film. And as you say, the American New Wave, as you call it, really kind of followed, you know, the Italian New Wave and then the French New Wave. And it's interesting, I think some of my favorite films are from the 50s. I have a really good handful of films that I think were even cutting ground. And of course, they were coming out of the neorealism, the Italian movement, especially with some of just this, you mentioned Nebraska being a quiet film. And I think that was sort of the approach. And you can still see the effects of that Italian neorealism, more showing. You were saying long shots. I think the idea that you show, you tell through the pictures and sort of the tone of the film. And so I think, you know, obviously going into the 60s, I mean, it was a big cultural revolutions happening. And I think American studios started to take more risks. Films of that time era were very cookie cutter. They were very formulaic. They followed a very safe platform. And I think as the 60s started changing these things, newer directors started coming in, newer actors that started trying things. And of course, the studio, like you said, if they were on a runaway coke train, they sort of just allowed directors and filmmakers to experiment and just sort of rethink the way films were shot. And I think we got some great films through the 60s and 70s. I mean, if you're saying the Easy Rider or the Graduate period to Raging Bull, I mean, that covers a good 15 to 20 year period there.
I think dominated by the 70s, though, really.
Agree 100%. My top films are really, like, just even in my top 20, I would say probably like half of them are from the 70s. And some of those films when I was really just too young to understand what they were all about, or, you know, wasn't allowed to see them at that time, you know, when I was a kid. But to me, looking back retrospectively, they are the best films, the top period, in my opinion, the 70s.
Yeah. My, like, film education was strange because, I mean, strange in a good way, because I had a school friend whose name is Edmund, who I'll get to listen to this because he loves films as well. And his mother had an incredible VHS, as it was then, collection. For the kids out there, that's a kind of clunky version of a DVD. And she had all this old stuff. And nobody was forcing me to watch Hitchcock and, you know, 50 sci-fi, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers and The Incredible Shrinking Man. I voluntarily watched those. And we kind of raided my friend's mother's VHS collection, as I said. You know, and I was being exposed to, you know, I mean, I loved Rear Window when I was like 13. It's ridiculous. And I remember watching The Deer Hunter when I was at probably 13, 14, the same, when I was at school.
Right. Wow.
So I don't know if that's impacted my life particularly, because musically I was sort of into the stuff any 13, 14-year-old was into. But film, I kind of had a bit of an edge going on there. And I don't want to give away your list, Jay Crush, but if I could just give the audience a few examples of ones that would perhaps be on both of our lists.
Sure.
And any of these that you don't want to reveal, we'll cut out in editing. But, you know, from this Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, I mean, typical examples would be One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Jaws, which I know isn't on your list. That would be on my list, but that's perhaps more sentimental, as well as it being a great film. But, you know, Midnight Cowboy, Marathon Man, and then The Graduate, you and I have discussed.
And interestingly, three films with Dustin Hoffman. So that kind of that kind of does give you an idea of the impact of his acting.
Just
the type of films that he's done.
That's interesting, because I didn't do that intentionally at all. I was just kind of scanning the list you gave me. But
I don't. I don't think you do that consciously. The roles that he was able to play, the diversity that he showed in his roles. You're not thinking Dustin Hoffman's my favorite actor, therefore I like these films. It's more like you like these films, and then you realize, you know, one of the common denominators is Dustin Hoffman, you know.
Yeah. I mean, there's other ones, of course. I mean, obviously, you know, De Niro, Pacino, Jack Nicholson, they're all over this period. Warren Beatty, I've never really understood the fuss. I know he was kind of a big personality in Hollywood, and he was also a producer, wasn't he? But I'm not quite understanding. I like Bonnie and Clyde.
Well, he was a hunk of the time period.
Right.
He was the hunk. And I mean, you know, his first role was alongside Natalie Wood, I believe, in Splendor in the Grass. And that was a film that was really looking at sexual taboos and kind of things like that, and how they were coming out of a period of conservatism, sexual conservatism, into the sexual revolution that happened in the 60s. And he was, you know, in the eyes of the culture at the time, just the pinnacle of handsomeness and things like that. And he did another film that I actually think is a really good film. It's called All Fall Down.
I don't know that one.
Yeah, I highly recommend that one. I think he did that after Splendor in the Grass. Okay. And so I think he does have a place there somewhere. I mean, of course, he directed Reds, which was one of the top films of the year, according to the Academy at that time.
That's early 80s, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what? To be honest, too, I think the Heaven Can Wait remake that he did with Julie Christie, I believe it was late 70s. I think it's just a great film. It's one of my all-time favorite films. Maybe not my top 100. So I think, Warren Beatty wasn't as, let's say, cutting edge as maybe, you know, a De Niro or a Jack Nicholson, somebody like that. But he definitely played a part.
Yeah, another example, obviously, of the 70s is Taxi Driver, and then Raging Bull, of course.
Sure.
I think Raging Bull is... sorry for the pun, but pound for pound, my favorite film. That's obviously a film which is in the world of boxing. Rocky, of course, is another one. I do like the original Rocky. They got a bit cartoony as they went on, but they were always good fun when I was a kid. But Raging Bull is about, ostensibly about boxing, but Scorsese wasn't really a boxing fan. And so he decided that the ring, the boxing ring, was, you know, the traps that we put ourselves in, or the traps we're in our lives. And all became metaphorical, you know, almost like the shark in Jaws in a way. I'm sure a lot of the audience will know the mechanical shark didn't work, so they decided to keep the shark under the water and you didn't see it for nearly an hour.
Right. But it still scared the shit out of you.
Sure. Obviously, that was a nod back to Psycho. You know, they were kind of trying to do what Psycho did for the shower, they did it for the ocean.
Yep.
Before that period, you know, really for me, Hitchcock all the way, and Stanley Kubrick was kind of before that period. And then he was in that period with Clockwork Orange, but I guess Barry Lyndon didn't quite fit that 70s thing, although I love it as a film.
I do too.
And then, of course, The Shining as well. So you got Jack Nicholson, the worlds of Kubrick and Nicholson meeting, which was interesting.
Very.
And then other stuff that we have sort of mutually in common would be early Tarantino, you know, Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. Yes. I really went off Tarantino badly from about Kill Bill onwards, but I know a lot.
Have you seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Yeah, that's one we could talk about. In short, I feel like there's lots of scenes. It tends to be a just almost a non-stop homage. And it feels like he'll do stuff like he'll say, everyone will be talking about some character, like, and they'll have like a Western scene where they go, I don't know, the boss isn't, he's not around today or something like that. And you'll have like, there'll be some big build up to this character. And I think, I can't remember which character it is in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but I think, is it Kurt Russell? I don't know if he's in that. They'll have a big build up.
He is.
And then I'm always waiting for the irony. Like, where's the irony? You've done like a complete copy of an old Western, but then now you're going to put the Tarantino stamp on it. And recently I feel like there's, I don't know what the Tarantino stamp is anymore, but I know you like this film. You can separate if you want.
Yeah, sure. I really liked it. It was one of the funnest moments I've had in a theater in a long time. As far as modern movies, you know, we kind of were talking about these periods, and you mentioned that you're not as, you know, maybe in the last 10 years up to date with some of the newer films. And, you know, I try to get out to the movies a few times a year. I love going to the cinema. I love the experience. I was lucky enough to actually see 2001, A Space Odyssey, for the anniversary in IMAX at my local cinema, which I went twice. It was just fucking awesome to see that on a big screen. I mean, in the IMAX with the sound. I mean, everything was just epic. And a lot of these films, I think, especially back then, they were really made for the big screen in the way they were shot. And you mentioned just longer takes or bigger takes. They were shot to really put you in awe when you were in the theater seeing it. And I think if you go back, sometimes people will go back to an older film, they'll put it on their Blu-ray or, you know, stream it live, and they'll watch it on their television. And as far as the impact of the photography and the scope of the shots and the detail and those things, they really can only, certain things can be captured on the big screen. And I really had a lot of fun going to see that movie just because the audience was kind of into it. They were excited. And it was just sort of that experience where everyone else is on this adventure together, you know, and everybody's kind of viewing it individually with their own filters and everything. I think I had that experience with going to see 2001 on the anniversary, and I was like dragging friends. I'm like, maybe they weren't even really like big movie people. The few friends I have, like close friends, and my brother, and then, you know, we went the first night and we were there. You know, when you're there and you're experiencing it together, and then you walk out of the cinema and you're talking about it, it's just like you're buzzing. It's like you went and saw a good band that just rocked your ass. You know what I mean?
So was that the 50th? Was that 2018?
Yes, about a year and a half ago.
I had a kind of something of a similar experience. Another film that's right up there is Apocalypse Now. And another one, of course, that benefited from a complete nightmare production. They kind of use it to their advantage because suddenly, you know, it's just about total confusion. Rather than being like a straight, oh, you know, Mili, there's this, there's the agreement to end the war. It's nothing like that. You're just plunged into this total mayhem. And I had a similar thing because in 2003, I think it was, they brought out the Redux, which added another 45 minutes. So you ended up with something like 3 hours, 23 and a half hours.
I've seen that one. Yeah,
it's good. Yeah, I went to a cinema in Leicester Square. I think it was the Empire, which is the biggest cinema in London. And it still had the like the tiered seating. So if you went up to the top, you were like really far
right
up. It's kind of added to it, being up at that height, added something to it. And anyway, I went on a Saturday afternoon to watch Apocalypse Now Redux. And the thing I was worried about, I hadn't been to the cinema for ages because I don't really go that much anymore. I used to go to sort of quiet art house films in the afternoons and stuff. Anyway, so what I was worried about was like, oh, is everyone just going to talk all the way through this film and just destroy this film experience? And I swear, I got in there. The cinema was pretty much packed. I'd say it was pretty much full. Nobody talked for three hours. And I looked at my... the only time I wasn't concentrating on the film was I looked at my watch when Brando appeared, because I was curious in this new version, like, at what point did Brando appear? And it's like 2 hours, 55 minutes, let's say, out of a 3.5 hour film. And he kind of did what Orson Welles did in The Third Man. He stole the film in the last half an hour.
Well, kind of like the shark in Jaws.
Yeah, Bruce the shark. Anyway, I mean, that was just an incredible experience. And I think as I've got older, I don't really go to gigs anymore. I go to sort of acoustic gigs. So my kind of buzz is a sort of slower thing nowadays.
Right.
And I just have so many wonderful memories of certain films, you know, a certain atmosphere or something. I was going to say, I used to be with friends, but now I'm become a terrible loner. Like, I think I spend most of my life in quarantine. All my work is online, you know, so I have to make an effort to keep making contact with the outside world. go on.
Well, no, well, you were just saying, you know, the experience of seeing Apocalypse Now, the Redux, nobody's talking. When I went and saw the 2001 anniversary, we went the first night, it was packed. And, you know, the whole Dawn of Man sequence in the beginning is just, there's no talking. And literally, you're so fixated, and I'm sitting there with popcorn, and it was so quiet. You didn't even want to eat the popcorn because it was going to, like, disturb people.
Oh, I love that.
People were so fixated. Like, you felt, like, bad that you just wanted to have a bite of popcorn because it was going to go, you know, crunch, and people were going to be like...
Yeah, it'd be almost like if you were actually one of the astronauts in space and Hal's trying to talk to you and you're eating popcorn. Can you stop eating popcorn, Dave?
You know, when they do show those, we have a local... cinema, old school, and it is, it's like it goes up, like you're saying, it's on an incline, the screen's down below, and they show a lot of old classics, you know, Hitchcock stuff too. And I went to college in the area, you know, I did take a couple of film courses in university just for electives and for fun. Ended up meeting a guy that really just, like, lived right down the corner from where I was living. Huge film buff, kind of an older guy. He's one of those dudes that went to college later. And he's like, oh, have you ever seen this movie? And I was like, no. And he'd come over with the, you know, the VHS tape or whatever, or the DVD. And we pop it in. And then he was like, oh, we got to go over to the cinema. They're showing this film. And I was like, oh, well, let's go. I remember we, you know, went out and we would just go to this and we'd watch these older films that really I didn't know about. And it was just a really cool experience to see. But I think now, you know, when those anniversaries come and they do come on the big screen, those are the fans come out for that. So you're not going to get some of the, you know, lameness that you would in a normal, just going to see a normal movie.
Yeah, you're going to get people who kind of respect it. And
exactly. They're, you know, serious.
They're going to be quiet. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Just a couple of other things from the list. Obviously, we're both musicians, and I noticed you had This Is Spinal Tap. So huge props to you for that. And also Pink Floyd. Pink Floyd, The Wall, which is a film with Bob Geldof as a kind of Sid Barrett / Roger Waters character, perhaps more Sid Barrett.
Right.
So those are two we could definitely do. And then you've got stuff like Wonder Boys, which I love. King of Comedy. Mm. Not the sort of go-to Scorsese film, but I absolutely love it.
I think it's one of his best, and it's one of the highest ones I have on there. Scorsese is definitely an influence of mine. And, you know, his films are scattered throughout my list.
Absolutely.
You know, as are Kubrick's.
Coppola, maybe.
Yeah, Coppola for sure. A lot of those directors. I like Steven Spielberg. I like him for sort of what he does, but I can't say that many of his movies are my top.
I mean, Jaws is obviously him. I like Jewel, which was a TV movie that they put in the cinema. Which is essentially the same thing as Jaws, really. It's a sort of Leviathan that gets destroyed in the end. But
I don't know that one.
Oh, you've never seen Jewel? Oh, that's very good. It's like an hour 10 or an hour 20.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a really good one. That's sort of officially his first film, although at the time it was a TV movie, so it wasn't considered. But... yeah, I mean, you know, we've got plenty to talk about in the future, so.
Yeah, with the music, you know, and how that relates to film. I mean, I remember seeing Pink Floyd, The Wall, and just being literally blown out of my seat as a kid, you know, and just kind of getting into Pink Floyd and hearing that music alone, and just the concept of The Wall in general. I think it's probably one of the greatest albums ever made, and how it was put to film with all these different themes and the way it showed. I mean, obviously you have the script that is just the music and the album, the lyrics and everything, but how they put all these images in and weaved in and out with the animation and just the different jump cuts and things that they put in there. And then you have this whole authoritarian thing going on, and you have these complex psychological issues, and so I love that. And then also just being in bands, especially when the hair band days were going. Spinal Tap was just such a funny mockery of the whole thing, because it really just that whole era of music. Looking back, I respect that era of glam a little more than I did at the time. I grew up as more into punk rock and punk attitude and all that kind of stuff. And so I was kind of not into glam at the time. Yeah. It was sort of like the mainstream kind of thing. And it really, that whole era kind of became a cliche of itself. And Spinal Tap just nailed it dead on. And really, Spinal Tap, it was Rob Reiner, right, that made that. I mean, not only did he nail it, but he started a whole new genre of spoof documentaries.
Mockumentaries.
Yeah, right. That's what they call the actual term for them now. Now they're all over the place, these kind of mockumentaries. They're even TV shows are shot like that now. And it's just, it was revolutionary and it was just brilliant. I mean, who would have thought that at the time, you know, it would create this whole other sub-genre, really?
Yeah, fabulous. Yeah, this is our 15-minute intro. It's got a bit longer.
Right.
Listen, just before I guess we do the outro, I am actually friends with Rob Ager. I think I told you this.
Yeah, you did.
If anyone hasn't heard of his work or seen it on YouTube, Rob Ager, A-G-E-R, he's a kind of a Kubrick specialist, I guess, but there's plenty of other stuff on there, sort of stuff about psychology, which is obviously a mutual interest. And I kind of met Rob as a fan in about 2011, and then I guess we've become friends, and I spent a bit of time with him last year when I was up in Liverpool. So I'm sure he wouldn't take too much persuasion to come on and talk about Kubrick. So Collative Learning is his website.
Collative Learning, right.
So yeah, as I said earlier, going forward, I guess it's going to be a mixture of deep dives. And then if there's any one particular issue that we want to talk about, we might make a shorter video. We might extract it as a clip. So anyway, we'll see how this goes and where this goes. Jay Kush and I are both pretty busy guys. So, you know, we'll fit it in somewhere. And I'm sure there'll be plenty of content coming in the future. So so thanks for doing this intro. And as I say on my my podcast outro is getting a bit too smooth. It's always like a, thanks for being on the program and good luck in the future. I try not to say it in too much of that kind of newsreader voice, you know, that horrible kind of desensitized. Today there was a plane crash in Nigeria that killed 53 people. The way they say it, with just like the total absence of emotion.
Right.
So it's not going to be like that. Anyway, folks, plenty coming in the future. So Jay Kush, thanks for doing this talk, and I will definitely talk to you in the future.
Now, big thanks. Thanks for having me on. It's great to be out here discussing things for all those people that are really into what we're into.
Yeah, just think a few weeks from now, there'll be people in gyms and on trains and on buses listening to us deep diving on The Graduate and Marathon Man and The Wall. And, you know, it'll all happen
definitely.
In good time. All right, folks. See you soon. Goodbye.
You can call me Jay Crash.
I see. Jay Crash and I are old friends. We used to play together when we were kids. That's not quite right. No, sorry, seriously. Yeah, should I take that out? We met.
This is good practice.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Well, I've been doing this for a fucking long time. I should be better.